Hi everyone, this is Luis Malmadrona, and I'm here with one of my heroes, actually, Donald Fixico, who wrote American Indian Mind in a Linear World. And it was one of the books that really helped me make sense of why I didn't fit in to the academy and why I had so much trouble with IRBs, with getting my research approved. And or getting research grants. And so his book was really helpful to me in terms of thinking about my identity versus the desired identity of the academy. And so I'm just really happy to welcome Donald Fixico, who's a professor at Arizona State University, home of the Sun Devils. Here at the University of Maine, we're the Black Bears. So there's not as much sun here as where you are. And so anyway, welcome. And I'd be happy if you could, if you would tell a little bit more about yourself for the benefit of the students and others who are watching. And then we'll launch into talking about your work.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Malmadrona, for giving me the opportunity to be with you and to be with your students for this time. And it's just a joy to kind of talk about your own work when you know, you do so many things for academia and for your university that it's not very often that we kind of get to delve into things that we really enjoy. It is kind of off the grid, I guess, meaning off the grid of outside of our besides, you know, the Western way of knowledge. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming. So I wondered if you could share with us the process that you went through in formulating the idea to write your book. And of course, I'm going to ask you about your later work beyond the book, but your book was so influential for me that I thought we could start there to ask you to talk about the process you went through in developing the ideas that are in the book and, you know, how that all came about.
Really began in two different ways. And I suppose that closest to me is when I was growing up and watching the elders at a distance and listening to them to speak, you know, the Muskogee language. And I'm really talking about where I grew up at the Gar Creek stomp ground for the Seminoles, because I'm Seminole and Muskogee on my father's side and kind of grew up in that tradition. And on my mother's side, I am also Shawnee and Sac and Fox. I was born in Oklahoma and raised in Oklahoma, thought I would never leave Oklahoma. So in growing up in the Muskogee and Seminole tradition, my hometown, Artelova, is Gar Creek. And so in growing up at Gar Creek, you know, as we went to dances literally all the time, I thought everybody did that on the weekends. And as I begin to get older and not realizing that we were kind of different, but not unusual from other native families. But it was watching the elders kind of talking in the Muskogee language, because the Seminole that I am is actually an offshoot of the Muskogee, so they speak the same language. And watching the elders sitting close to the ground, sometimes holding a stick and drawing in the dirt and talking. And as they talked, and I could kind of understand what they were talking about at a distance, then it was that kind of boyhood or that child experience. And as I grew older and became educated through the public school systems in Oklahoma and the state of Oklahoma, then on to the University of Oklahoma, I've taken 3 degrees from University of Oklahoma in history, a bachelor's, a master's degree, and also a PhD. Then I thought that as I read these works that Westernization has produced, the mainstream college system, then who speaks for the elders? what do the elders, you know, they're thinking, they live, that's part of my life too, and who represents them in a respectful way? And so that strong influence of representing the elders as in their own way, in their own worldview, and the way that they thought about things and made decisions, I wanted that to kind of come through so that it would be in a very understanding way, and not to disrespect them, but also bring them a measure of acknowledgement and recognition that what they were doing and still do and will continue to do could be included in everything that we know and understand in academia and outside of academia. So that was really kind of the goal or the objective or the mission that I was on, to bring that kind of perspective. But it doesn't speak for all Native people. It really speaks for how that I grew up in the Muskogean and Seminole tradition. Because when you look all across, and there's almost 600 Indian nations that are federally recognized, then the Comanches think a certain way, and there's a Mohawk logic, and the Cheyenne have their own ethos. And so we all have our different voices, but when you look at them in a binary situation of Indian-white relations, then obviously Native people who are close to their traditions and raised that way don't think like the mainstream. Because I find myself, I found myself thinking not like the mainstream, and actually struggling in school. I mean, grade school was a breeze because you memorize things. But as you get into college, then you begin to learn how to analyze and how to do that. But as I read the academic books, I begin to wonder, why am I wrong? Why don't I understand the books like everybody else in the classroom? And then going on and becoming an assistant professor and assigning, you know, the books and as a young scholar, then as a full professor, then still assigning the books in seminars, and I read them in a different way than my graduate students. And instead of believing that I was wrong, it's just another way of understanding. And I thought that different way of understanding is not wrong at all. It's just a different way of understanding. If you turn that around, maybe the mainstream is misunderstanding things. And so that was kind of the second reason for the motivation for writing this book called The American Indian Mind. And as you notice the title, The American Indian Mind in a Linear World. And so it's that linear world that Native people who are close to their traditions and how that they think, their logic, the way that they see things, come from their different tribal worldviews. It sometimes is a struggle because in the influence of the Western way of thinking and expression in academia, then if you don't think in kind of an empirical way, then you're wrong. And so you're graded that way, you're criticized that way. The Western way is really one of criticism, so you have to have the evidence. Yeah, that's the truth. But there are different ways of understanding the truth. And that was the second reason for wanting to write this particular book.
And I'm so glad that you did write it. You know, that we talk a lot here in Maine about two-eyed seeing, and Albert Marshall, in Mi'kmaq, it's Heptuoptamunk, the idea of that the indigenous epistemology and worldview is equally valid to the contemporary mainstream worldview. And obviously it's an ongoing process to bring that into people's awareness. But, and I really appreciated how you did that. So I wondered if you could explain, if you could compare and contrast for the students the linear way of thinking to the circular way of thinking.
Well, I have to begin with a story. In my teaching at the universities I've been at, it's always, I've been told that I'm a storyteller. And so I try not just to tell the story, but to kind of take the story apart and explain different parts of it and why that they might be relevant and how that we can learn from stories. It's kind of following the indigenous way, but so let me just kind of begin with the story. And the story is not an old one. It's a new one that happened to me. It's an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. That was my first full-time faculty job. And so I'm teaching an American History Survey class at 4:30 called a trailer course. And it's a course I didn't particularly enjoy teaching. It was at 4:30, and because it was a required course in the college, then a lot of students were there that didn't want to be there, and I didn't want to be there, but we had to kind of slog through this American History Survey course. And of all things that I was speaking about for that lecture topic that afternoon at 4:30, was given a lecture on Calvin Coolidge. You cannot make Calvin Coolidge interesting. He did some significant things during this time period, including signing into law that brought about U.S. citizenship for all of Native people in 1924. But other than that, I mean, Calvin Coolidge is just really boring. So as I then was teaching the course and giving the lecture, back in the old days, when we had chalkboards called blackboards. And so I wrote in the middle of the board, of the blackboard, Calvin Coolidge. And in doing that, then I wrote something like Republicanism in the corner. Then in the opposite corner of the blackboard, I wrote something like laissez-faire business tactics. And in another corner, I wrote something like women's struggle for women's rights and what was going on. And then I drew lines from those different topics with Calvin Coolidge in the middle, towards the middle of the board where Calvin Coolidge. And I thought that was the best way to explain how Calvin Coolidge was right in the center of things, of the discussion and of the lecture, and all these other things related to him, like spokes on a wheel, with him being the hub. And as I was in the process of doing that, then a young lady shot up her hand and she said, "Professor Fixico, how come you don't make your notes in the upper left-hand corner and go across, and the next thing you mark it number two and go across?" And what I began to realize is that she was thinking and accepting me to give the lecture in a very linear fashion. And what I was doing was using a circular approach. And so you can imagine my teaching evaluation at the end of the semester. They just took a nosedive. And so I began to realize that my approach was more kind of a circular way of thinking and delivering that. And if you put Calvin Coolidge in the middle, how can you not forget Calvin Coolidge with all these things kind of related to him in kind of a historical context? But to the linear mind, that was not the way that they were taught to learn. And as I thought about that years later on, I thought, well, this is really kind of interesting because they're taking notes on Calvin Coolidge, writing from left to right in a linear fashion, but then the world is rotating and in a circular fashion, and the rest of the universe is rotating in a circular fashion and day into night and so forth and on. And so we live in a linear world, but all things around us rotates, and there are patterns of circles and cycles and things like that. And we tend to forget about that when we use a linear fashion approach. Well, I think you're muted.
Sorry, you make me think of this notion of the circle or the horizon, and that we stand in the center and we look around us 360 degrees to see to what we relate. To whom are we relating from this center point at which we stand? It is a very different perspective from the linear, A causes B causes C causes D, because we know that everything is interconnected and interdependent. I gave a talk this morning to the North American Primary Care Research Group about systems dynamics computer modeling, which is a way of representing interconnected and interdependent variables that eliminates dependent, the notion of dependent and independent. And that came out of some discussions we've been having here at the University of Maine about how would we do quantitative methodology in an indigenous way? And this was my response to that question, is that we would do it circularly. We would do it in terms of feedback loops and interdependence and interconnectedness. And we would eliminate this notion that you can control variables, because you can't. And we would eliminate this notion that there is independence in the universe. And we would, you know, embrace interdependency. And, you know, which is where, you know, I'm trying to go. And there's a couple people who have written a book on indigenous statistics, which I'm beginning to delve into, which is equally fascinating. And I wondered if that resonates at all with where you were thinking and where you've been thinking and where you're heading at this time.
Oh, indeed, it does. The two main points I think that drive the American Indian Mind book is circularity, the circularity approach, and understanding that. When I write, the press editors say, "Don, you're being repetitive again." It's just that, you know, you make a point and then you come back to it. And then, you know, I come back to it to make sure that people understand. And then I come back to it. And so my writing doesn't move in a linear fashion. So I have to go back and hammer out the circularity in order to move the story along. And so in the circularity, that means that everything is kind of within that circle. But what is that circle called? I was raised in a tradition, as I said, Muscogee and Seminole, so that we believe in a realm that is referred to as Ibufunga. And Ibufunga is not God. It can be and cannot be, but what it means basically is totality. It's a totality of everything that is known and not known within that realm. And so within that realm that everything is, it's like a huge bubble, then it fluctuates and moves and grows, but everything is really kind of connected to each other or related to each other. And so what we need to do in this approach is to try to understand all of our relations, our relationships as well as we can. That means the human relationships as well as the non-human relationships. And trying to understand in a way that we can see or hear, you know, what birds are talking about in the mornings. I go running every morning. I run at my speed. And so in the process of running, it was during the summertime that I didn't really break it, but anytime that my little kind of battery radio gets moisture on it, then I have to buy a new one because of the moisture, it stops it from working. So I started running at my own pace without it and listening to the sounds of nature. And so there are 27 birds, 27 different species of birds in the Phoenix area where I live. And about 45% of them are house finches. Another 40% are mourning doves. And when I run in the morning, you can hear the birds talking to each other, but it's largely the house finches that are talking to each other. And so they have a language, but what is more important than language is understanding. Because you can understand a cat. We have a cat, and a cat, a house cat, makes 28 distinct sounds. Watch their tail, those of you who have cats, and dogs as well. And so you can understand what a cat is trying to tell you or to show you or how that they feel by understanding their sounds. And so that's really kind of a language, but what supersedes language is understanding. So in a way, you know, animals, especially a dog, can protect you. And so you understand that relationship there, and it becomes symbiotic in a way that the dog depends on you, especially if you're out hunting or jogging or something like that, and other animals too, if we can understand their language, but it's understanding that superstitious language. So we take a person like all of us and put ourselves in the middle. It's a binary relationship with each bird or dog or cat or another person or another nation. And so it becomes a reciprocal relationship that is mutual, and learning to respect that. And then that kind of approach, I refer to that in my work as a natural democracy. The natural democracy is where that we should show respect and equality to the house finch that I heard this morning. Because a house finch is trying to tell you something, or maybe not wanting to tell you something. And they're probably telling each other that, hey, I saw a cat not too far away, a predator. But we can understand and gain knowledge, indigenous knowledge, from the earth itself. I kind of refer to that, my work is earth knowledge, and learning from the animals and learning the language of plants and trees and the forest and rivers and things like that. If we just know how to listen and know how to learn, and that's the hardest thing, because it's learning from the expression of nature.
Yeah, you know that, I mean, and what you're saying reminds me of that popular book, Braiding Sweetgrass, you know, which brought that message to a lot of people. And there's another indigenous writer whose name I'm blocking on right now. I apologize to her, but she writes about the importance of our acknowledging our relationships to the other than humans and the more than humans in our environment, you know, as we move through the world. And you know, I think when one does that, the whole notion of linearity just collapses as a philosophy. Though many people haven't noticed, you know. I'm sure.
Well, we can learn much more if we can understand and observe people's actions and try to interpret them, because a lot of things are shared which are not spoken about. The second, I guess, important point in the book, The American Indian Mind, is visual analysis or visuality. So what we see is so important, but also how we understand that, and to understand that in a reciprocal way, in a receiving way or acceptance, rather than trying to pass judgment on it and to say, well, you know, my interpretation, I'm sorry that you understand it, that it's wrong. Well, it's not necessarily wrong. It's just a different way of understanding or expression. And so being more visual, if you take, for example, that words convey really only about 7% of what we're trying to say. And so 93% of what is said is or understood is made up by facial expressions and voice tone. And so we need that other 93% or about 90% to see someone, to see how that they're saying that and how that they're using their hands and their tone of their voice or something like that, so that we can understand, because we as human beings, we don't listen very well. Only about less than 10%, about 7% is what we hear. So the information that we take in, we need to kind of be very visual at the same time, because there's a lot that is being shared, and sometimes the wrong words are being used, because what the person is really trying to convey is what they really think, but they might be saying something different. And if they say something different, then we're listening to that and we're taking in the wrong message of what is really true or how that they feel about something in particular. And so language is really superseded by understanding. And when you take the English language, there is something about about 500,000 words in the English language. And so when you think about 500,000 words, that's a lot of words. But there's sometimes when you talk about native things, you talk about indigenous topics, that there are no English words to convey that. So the English language tends to break down. And so you have to be very descriptive in English. And that's how some tribal languages work too. You have to be more descriptive. So you're trying to say elephant, the word elephant, and you say a big animal with a long nose. And so the translation becomes, you know, a very long spoken series of phrases in order to convey the meaning of elephant. So that's why visuality is so important, because the eyes take in, you know, we see so much and to take it in, but sometimes we only see what we want to see. So if we can see with a wider mind and a little bit more liberal, then we can learn much more. And I think that's why, you know, Native people have always been kind of great visual scholars of not just human beings, but, you know, the non-humans and Mother Nature and of the past and the present and obviously of the future.
Indeed. And you make me think of a friend of mine who's an anthropologist, was adopted into one of the tribes in Oklahoma. And his adopting father asked him to convey his wisdom or thoughts, you know, to the non-Indian world. And my friend, whose name is Bob Vetter, who also graduated from the University of Oklahoma in anthropology, dutifully brought his equipment to this elder's home and proceeded to record hours of teachings. And he told me that the teachings made total sense to him in the moment at the time. But when he listened to the recordings, it made no sense at all. And he said he learned a really important lesson, that you had to be there in the flesh to understand that just reading the words would not bring you to that place of understanding that the elder was trying to take you. And he slowly did eventually finish the book that he wrote with this elder, but it didn't work from recordings. He wasn't able to use the recordings because he couldn't make sense of them. And I wonder, does that fit with what you were saying?
Yes, I think so, because I'm going to go in the direction of oral tradition here for a second or two. Because stories are so very powerful. But I guess the question would be then is, why are they powerful? Why are they effective? Native people obviously didn't have a written expression, you know, Sequoia, the Cherokees, then other tribes would later on develop written languages. And so that meant that the dependency was really on storytelling or the oral tradition. But in telling the stories in the oral tradition, that meant recreating the reality of the past and recreating the reality so effectively, and it depends on the ability of the storyteller, that an effective storyteller can bring people in the present back to that past reality and recreate that reality. They can describe how cold it was that day, if it was raining, what the feeling in a room was or at a treaty council, and all of that. And so instead of a person trying to read something in black and white in a book and then trying to remember and understand from that point, it's very hard because there's no realism. The realism has to be conveyed through the written word. But if you describe that, you can be a very effective at taking a class back to the Treaty of Medicine Lodge councils, you know, that were negotiated for a week, or to another place, or to a battle, or to maybe just a simple story. And so storytellers are able to recreate that reality because I think we as human beings we, you know, have not evolved that much. And so we have to kind of be in the moment that we truly understand. And as a historian, that's why teaching history is sometimes really challenging, because people just don't care. But until you really kind of recreate that story for them, then you take them past, back into the past, wherever that may be, like Tecumseh leading, you know, the warriors in the Ohio River area during the period of the War of 1812. So you have to be able to do that very effectively and in a contemporary way. Doing it in the contemporary way, you really have to know more details and be like a detective in order to recreate that. And then join that, I think, with the oral history tradition of Native people. So that's really kind of a combination. That is, I think, conveying storytelling effectively and recreating that realism to people who might be in the audience who are also non-Native. Mm-hmm. Now, if they're of the same tribal tradition, then I don't think you have to do so much, because they would know, have some really understanding of being Cherokee or being Mohawk or Cheyenne. And so they would already have a sense, a kind of a innate understanding, a feeling of what it might have been like for Sweet Medicine to go up on Bear Butte and to learn the messages that he was told by, you know, the spiritual elders. If you're Cheyenne, I think it would be easier to understand that. But if you're not Cheyenne, and even if you're another tribe like I am, it's harder to understand that. And so it kind of puts the weight or the burden on the storyteller to kind of go beyond and to teach us non-Cheyenne about the importance and the challenges that Sweet Medicine faced as he tried to learn, you know, these messages from the spiritual elders at Bear Butte.
Right. And you make me think of Brian Burkhart, whom you may know, who teaches at the University of Oklahoma, who says that all knowledge is local. And it may not transfer from the valley here to the valley across the mountain over there. That whatever we know where we know it. And we know it because it's us who know it. And someone else might not know it and might not see it. And in the next valley over, it might not be true. I mean, it might not be useful knowledge, you know, one, you know, cross one mountain into another valley and it might not pertain. And I mean, is that relevant to what you've been thinking?
Well, I think so. Local knowledge is very powerful. And I believe there's different kinds of knowledges, but if we use the example of Tecumseh, and I guess he would be on your right side in the picture. So there's Tecumseh wearing the peace medal of the Shawnee, the peace medal of George III. So right behind me. And so that's Tecumseh. And if you think about what he had to do or what he wanted to do was to form this kind of confederacy of different tribes to stop westward expansion of Americans coming across the Ohio River into the Ohio River. And so he tried to do that, but what he did was to travel with an entourage of warriors from different parts of not the Ohio River, but other areas too. And so as he traveled with these different warriors who were loyal to him and believed in the same mission, believed in the same vision that he shared with his brother, the Shawnee prophet, he was also, in his entourage, had warriors who spoke Ojibwa, who spoke Choctaw, who spoke these different languages. Well, maybe not Choctaw, because Pushpataha wasn't quite in favor of Tecumseh. But not only did they bring their different languages with them, and so they were interpreters for him as they went to these different areas, like if they went into their home area. Well, if you think about it, it's not only them interpreting for him and him learning those new languages, but they were also interpreting the local knowledge that they possessed as they went into those areas. But if you think about it, the entourage was like a map guide. And so everywhere he went, he would ask somebody, well, this is your land. This is your homeland. This is your earth. What is it that is very important that we should know? And so he would, each of the warriors would know the local knowledge of where the next river was, where to hunt, where to find food, and things like that. And so that's transporting or having that kind of venue for using local knowledge in that particular way.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And I have so many questions, but I didn't want to forget to ask you. So what's current for you now in your scholarship? What's exciting you this week in your thinking and what you're writing and teaching?
Largely it's trying to get through the teaching, my teaching responsibilities. And I teach a graduate course. It's our History 641, and it's looking at all the historical debates through historiography. And so it's going out of my comfort zone a little bit. And last night we talked about progressivism, having nothing to do with Native history or Native studies or anything. And so it's that extra, you know, responsibility. I find it very interesting that, you know, why is it somebody that, like myself, who is a so-called expert in a certain area, and I'm teaching American history. And so why can't an American historian teach Native history for me, or teach a course on Native history? So when we teach in the mainstream, then sometimes all of us who teach in a certain area, we have to teach the mainstream at the same time. The mainstream doesn't necessarily teach what we can teach. And so that's the challenge for us when we do that. The other course that I have two courses this semester. It's called Outlaws and Indians and Ladies of the West. And so it's talking about Jesse James and Billy the Kid. And so yesterday we talked about, in class, we talked about Wovoka and the sun, the ghost dance, and how that challenged, you know, those practitioners, including Sitting Bull of the Sun Dance. It didn't just challenge Christianity, but it challenged the Native belief systems of other Native groups. But what I'm working on right now is I've finished a book manuscript on what I call Indian Territory and Manifest Destiny. I think race, power, and blood. And so it's how that my home state, Oklahoma, was called one time Indian Territory. And I have 12 chapters on removal that I refer to as moving fire. Also the Civil War period, outlaws are in there as well. The land rush is in there as well. The railroad contest or race of the Iron Horse coming into the Indian Territory as well. The push for the state of Sequoia is in there as well. That's 12 chapters. And that is spun off into a current book that I'm writing on of 8 chapters is called Chito Harjo and the Crazy Snake Movement. And it's referred to really as the Crazy Snake Rebellion, but why is it a rebellion? In my interpretation, then he was really kind of fighting and arguing for the old ways to be continued. And I find it very interesting, you know, that the first American museum just recently opened, and within 2 weeks, what were they doing? They were holding a stomp dance in the first American museum in Oklahoma City, and will continue. Because the old ways and what Chito Harjo is talking about, there's a word that we have called boificha. And that's really kind of a natural spirit or a natural sovereignty, a natural, that's what is in everything. And that has been with us for centuries and centuries and centuries. And it will continue because it helps to give us our identity. And that boificha is not just for Native people, but it's that innate feeling for all of us of human beings and non-humans to continue that life spirit. That's boificha, and I think that's what he was talking about, and that's what I'm going to argue in this interpretation of the old ways, and that life continuum of boificha needs to kind of be presented in a very respectful way, and that's my objective in this latest book project.
It sounds fabulous. It sounds like something that I really want to read. And when do you think it'll be out?
Oh, I'm still. Well, you know this well because you're very well published yourself, and you know what it takes to when you write a book, and I'm pretty sure you've written more books than I have, then you know where I'm going with this.
Yes, I do.
The hardest thing to do in this I found in this world is to find time.
Yeah.
To carve out time for your own work, because as you know so well too, 80% is really for someone else or for something else. And if we get 10% of 20% time left, then 15% you're doing something for your wife or your family or for your home. And that maybe 2% or 3%, that's when you look forward to. And maybe it's early in the morning or late at night when you're able to kind of look up an article or to squeeze out a paragraph and or hopefully to dash something, you know, down on the page, and so that you've got something to look at. And I am not a born writer. I've edited and published 15 books, but each one I've thought was my last one. And so I'm just a hammer and tong guy, just hammering it out and hammering it out until, you know, it's kind of acceptable to me, and then kind of sending it off. And I get criticized pretty heavily, and I'm not afraid of that anymore, because I think my feeling is that, well, I've got it wrong anyway, but I'm going to write it in a convincing way that people might see, you know, the value in it. And so that's what I hope for. My writings don't win a whole lot of prizes at all, because it's coming from a very kind of native point of view. And a lot of people don't understand that. And so I think where the scholarship is now is really kind of in the middle of shared experiences, even if it's about boarding schools or intermarriage or Indian Wars or something like that. But you have to see the mainstream actors of history kind of in that. And those books in particular are the ones that win prizes. Mine is totally on the other side, where that it's coming from a native perspective. And it's only when individuals like yourself kind of see the value in that are able to kind of reach over to where I'm coming from and say, that might be important. And so my work might be more for those people who are more broader thinking or accepting. I'm not sure.
Well, and I think, you know, in universities all across the world, there are those of us who are trying to advance the indigenous way of thinking. And it's an uphill struggle because the linear mind won in the sense of colonization and conquest and control, you know. And I think about, there's a marvelous book that I just read by a woman named Singh about the mushroom at the end of the world. And she writes about the goal of settler colonial capitalism to control nature and everything. And that the linear project is one of control. And she says it's failing, as in global warming and, you know, all kinds of other things, that because you can't control the world. You know, and she says that indigenous people all over the world could have told the capitalists this, you know, that their project was doomed because you can't control the world. It's not going to go that way. But, you know, of course they didn't listen. But I think you know, we're all engaged in this process of promoting indigenous thinking. And one of my hopes in making these recordings is for us to get to know each other, you know. Yeah. And I think about one of the people I interviewed whom I particularly enjoyed was Carl Mica from the University of Canterbury in New Zealand, who's professor of indigenous studies there. And he talked about, he had a lot to say about our uphill battle in the academy to exist at all. And even more fundamentally, to demand equivalence with the linear logic of the academy. And so I think we're all out there trying, you know, and I'd like to think that we're helping young people to move ahead, you know, because we're in a generation well, you know, we went through a lot of stuff. And I'm really hopeful that the efforts that you're making and that I'm making and others, Carl Mica is making, will make it easier for young people to stand on our shoulders and push it forward, push it up, you know. And do you have thoughts about that?
Oh, indeed, because sometimes I think what I write will not help too much right now, but maybe for the next generation. Because I've been told and I've learned over the years that the hardest thing to change about people is the attitude of people. And so when we finally write, and in history, we talk about signature books, we talk about foundational books, but the most important kind of book we think in history is a pivotal book that changes the course of thinking and changes the attitude of people and all of that. But as you said, you know, it's swimming upstream, or it's going uphill all the way. And it's even more challenging in a way when you think about the number or the amount of Native scholars who know what Indigenous knowledge is. There's really kind of two types, I think. And one of them is more organic, and that's very separate from contact and mainstream influences. Then you have a kind of an Indigenous knowledge that began to emerge after World War II, and certainly in the 1960s, that was really experiencing a kind of a foil attempt where it kind of ricocheted or bounced off of mainstream knowledge. And that was really, you know, during the protest of the American Indian movement and other Indian activism. And so you have that kind of, especially in law, in policy, policy history, and you have that kind of Indigenous knowledge. Well, those are two separate types in my mind. And when you look at Indigenous knowledge, one of my friends, colleagues, Brian Braveboy, he says we have this debate here going on because I refer to it as just Indigenous knowledge, and he refers to it as Indigenous knowledges with an S, a plural. And so he's right because, you know, there's the Comanche Indigenous knowledge, and there's the Cheyenne, and there's the Inuit and all of that. But as a number of scholars who were raised close to their traditions becomes fewer, then somehow we need to kind of make that connection back with the earth and with our people and our ways. And I think that can be done. It's more challenging because, as I was saying a little bit earlier about listening to the birds in the morning and watching our family pets and other animals and learning from them, Indigenous knowledge is not necessarily all Indigenous people, but learning from the earth and the animals and everything itself. And one doesn't have to be a Native person. We've had plenty of, captives, you know, all across our tribal histories. And those people who came into our ways and societies, like Cynthia Ann Parker among the Comanches, she learned to be Comanche and was kind of reborn, but we don't think about her in that way. We think about her as really taken as a captive and being brutalized. But in a way, she transitioned from a young white girl as she grew into adulthood and married and was among the Comanche. Then she became Comancheized and learned to think and talk and speak their language and to understand their worldview. So it's that kind of reach or to be able to connect with that kind of embedded knowledge of our various tribes and different tribal worldviews it's that embeddedness, that kind of knowledge that I refer to in my own work as deep knowledge. Yes, we have local knowledge and we have embedded knowledge, but it's that kind of deep embedded knowledge that is kind of a part of our identity and who we are. We also have sacred knowledge, I think, too, as well. But, you know, that's, we should only approach that in a respectful way. And I think we also have something kind of also related to is maybe earth knowledge. Rivers and things like that, and how why water is so important, because the human body, about 70 or 75% is water. So knowing about the earth, I think that's a kind of a different kind of knowledge related to embedded knowledge. But I, in my work, I refer to it as earth knowledge.
Right. And you know, I there's been a discussion about the need to overthrow this sort of binary, you know, of indigenous, non-indigenous, and earth, non-earth. And I think some of it comes out of the Blood Quantum Act of 1904, in, you know, this notion of changing citizenship to pedigree, so that instead of full citizens of nations, we became thoroughbred horses or dogs. And before 1904, someone could just join the nation. I mean, I think about John Ross, who was the head chief of the Cherokee for the Trail of Tears and Death, who was technically 7/8 Scottish.
Yeah.
Yet he was fully Cherokee because he was a member of the nation. He was even the chief. And I think about, yes, those accounts of settler women who chose to stay with their captors because it was better. They liked it better, they discovered. I mean, the worldview and the lifestyle. And it seems like somehow we have to reclaim that. I'm not sure how we do that, but we have to reclaim our sovereignty, I would say, as opposed to our pedigree. I mean, does that make sense? Do you resonate with that?
Oh, indeed. This is where I think sometimes the English language breaks down, and also the way of proving things, and especially as a historian, the way that I was trained academically, the evidence has to be there. But if you take, for example, I mean, how do we know that black holes exist in the universe? There's no evidence for that. And so what you do is like a jigsaw puzzle. You find out things around it, the stars and planets around the black hole, then therefore there must be a black hole. And finally now scientists have discovered that there are sounds coming from black holes. So you have to kind of take a leap of faith sometimes and sometimes delve into a little bit of theory. And certainly fate for understanding Native people and our reality, our past and our stories, because we also believe in ghosts and spirits and things like that. And, you know, it's often been said, well, I don't believe in ghosts, but I'm afraid of them. So we have to kind of sometimes make assumptions and say, well, the evidence is going to turn up or it's going to be there. But we as human beings, you know, we haven't evolved to accept things so much that it has to be proven in a linear kind of Western approach. And so Western learning does gain when it uses theory a little bit. And historians were afraid of theory. But I use it in my own work because, you know, it's just there. And so I think that Native scholars and Native people are more accepting of things that are there, are possible. And that's why I argue in my own work that our reality is a tandem of the physical reality and the metaphysical reality, that we have been able to function and live quite happily and successfully in accepting, you know, ghosts and spirits and things that can't be explained. If you worry about them so much, you're going to get caught into kind of a state of confusion. And in the Creek and Seminole tradition, we refer to it as ihosa. And ihosa is that kind of web of confusion, and a powerful medicine maker could even put a spell of Ihosa on a person. But if you get caught in Ihosa, you could literally, you know, worry yourself to death and anxiety and stress like that, and just recognize when Ihosa is happening, because it's also kind of rivers on the earth that we know that are dangerous and to stay out of, and to cut across quickly. If you have to cross such rivers on the earth, they're not really rivers, but they're kind of danger zones. And you recognize them immediately because your amygdala goes off and kind of lets you know instinctively that this is not a good place to be, especially at night, because, you know, powers, you know, come away at night, and sometimes powers during the day, sometimes powers are awakened during the seasons or certain years and things like that. And we're not aware of those things until, you know, our body, with our embedded knowledge, then kind of tells us, you know, as we watch the animals and plants and things like that, that, you know, this is dangerous. And so we need to kind of be conscientious of those things and to listen to our bodies and to how that we feel and how that we see things. And we can sustain ourselves much more. And I think Native people have been trying to do that for the earth, but I think not enough non-Native people have been listening.
Right, indeed. And you remind me of a sort of humorous aside, that it wasn't until I got to medical school that I realized that other people in the mainstream didn't talk to spirits. I was shocked. I was like, really? What? Yeah. You must be so lonely. What's wrong with you people? And then I quickly figured out that you shouldn't tell people that you talk to spirits, because you could get labeled. Yes. That wasn't a smart idea.
Yeah. But, you know, what is it that angels have been mentioned in the Bible like 273 times? The presence of God has been mentioned in the Bible 50 times. And I think the devil has been mentioned in the Bible like 35 times. This is kind of fresh in my brain, because yesterday I just finished giving a lecture on Wovoka and the ghost dance. And so I brought this up because, you know, as he went on his journey after the eclipse and was given this message to bring back to the Paiute people and for other people who had joined him, then I thought, well, I might have some doubters in my class, and probably do. But, you know, so I bring examples from the Bible of, you know, angel appearances and the presence of God and the presence of the devil and so forth. And they're sprinkled all throughout the Bible.
Indeed. But I think mainstream people say, well, that was then, but it doesn't happen now. And there was a Pope actually who said that. And I'm sorry, I don't follow Catholics well enough. I'm not sure which Pope it was, but that all of those things are happened, but they're not contemporary.
And yes, but I wonder what sustains people in their beliefs.
Good question. Yeah.
If the presence isn't there, then why is that belief system continued? Something has to keep us going. And see, it's not really empirical science, because you can't prove it.
Right.
And so it's our devotion, or our loyalty, or our commitment, or our drive to be alive, going back to Poi Victa, and that sustains us and gives us hope. If we lose hope in the future and hope in the human beings and non-human beings, then we're in trouble, and we might be on the brink of trouble already.
Yeah. There's a Lakota story that says that as there's an eagle who flies across the sky every day in the morning. And as long as one person is praying, then humanity is okay. But if that last person stops praying, then it's all over. So hopefully there's more than one still praying.
Yes.
So before we stop, I wondered if you could tell a little bit more about Wewoka and the ghost dance, because, you know, that's certainly a defining event in the history of my father's people, the massacre at Wounded Knee, and it was a ghost dance in preparation to be conducted. And I just wondered if you could, you know, say a little bit more, because I just love to hear more about that.
Well, Volk is a very interesting and extraordinary person that was born, and he was the Northern Pine in the area called Nevada, as it became Nevada the state. And as he was a young man, he really was not a person who wanted the spotlight, it seems to me, from what I've read and what I've been able to piece together, because in this course that, you know, we try to analyze personalities and levels of intelligence and things like that. Or if you don't, then Jesse James was a bad guy, Billy the Kid was a bad guy, Black Bart was a bad guy. So what is it in their lives, and especially their young lives, that makes them different? And so with Wovoka, as a young person, at the age of 8, he worked for a rancher by the name of David Wilson. And David Wilson was married to a woman by the name of Abigail Wilson. And the Wilsons were devout Christians. And so they hired young Wovoka, and he gains the name Wovoka. It means woodcutter in the Paiute language. And so he works from about the age of 8 to he's almost 30 years old for the Wilsons on their ranch. And it's during that time that he's told stories by the Wilsons about the Bible, in the Bible, and the Bible being important. And so it seems that he's influenced by Christianity, yet he has that embedded knowledge that I was referring to a little bit earlier of being Paiute. And so as he then undergoes a kind of a journey, a visual journey, and this is an individual who doesn't seem to be wanting these things. I teach my classes, try to teach them there's three kinds of change. Change by force, and that kind of change doesn't happen if people don't want to change. There's change or voluntary change, and people will change their lives overnight if they want to do that. So that's voluntary change. But the third kind of change is divine change, like lightning striking, or it comes from a supernatural power or something like that. And in Wovoka's case, I think it's probably that divine force, that third kind of change that came into his life. So with the eclipse occurring and then him making this kind of heavenly journey and coming back with the message, it's not his message, but it was a message that was told to him to share with the people. So he's like a conduit in that way. And so he brings that message that we need to prepare for the coming of a new world. And this new world would bring about the return of those people who died, loved ones. They would come back to life, and the buffalo would return. So it's a world renewal. It's a new world in a way, but people had to do certain things. They had to believe. And it's at a time in late 1800s when there's like 200 reservations with Native people being placed on reservations. And we can't really say POW because prisoners of war doesn't become a term that's coined until 1919. So we can say POWs with an asterisk, 1919. But they were literally dying on reservations from poverty, from disease, and things like that. But what Wovoka discovered is they hadn't lost hope yet. There was still something, you know, that was, and that's what they had basically is hope, in that something would happen that would bring about a better life if they prepared and did the right things by committing themselves and their belief to the ghost dance and to learning it, to practice it, to learn the songs. And that was incredible because it's the largest gathering of Native people all across the nation. When you think about it, that it crossed over into 16 different states, reservations in California, Oregon, the Basin area, the Northern Plains, into the western part of Indian Territory, into Texas, the Panhandle, Kansas, Nebraska. I mean, that's a lot of Indian country that it covered, and it had that awing effect that even some non-Native people believed in it, because it seemed like some Christianity was involved in it too, because Wovoka talked about Jesus traveling and delivering the gospel and talking about Christianity. And in a way, he was doing the same thing as he became known as the Indian Messiah. So all that was to happen. And so when things did begin to happen, and maybe they don't happen overnight, because when you think about the Indian population, I'll just end with a couple more comments here, that the Indian population had become less than 238,000 in the entire 48 states. When Columbus arrived, there was a safe estimate of maybe 5 million, and some scholars have said 20 million, 25 million, maybe 50 million indigenous people when Columbus arrived. Well, less than 238,000 in the time period of Wovoka's life. So we were almost becoming extinct and being referred to as the vanishing race. And you look at the Indian population now, it's somewhere about 5.2 million. How does that happen? Maybe this new earth is returning, but we have to reach the bottom first, our experience and you know what it is in order to appreciate what we are having. One of the books that I wrote is called Resilience and Rebuilding. And so in a way, it's not looking at the water gourd being half empty, but let's look at it half full and talk about and think about what we've done since then.
Yeah, that's so important. And you know, in my clinical work, I work with so many people who have been terribly traumatized, you know, across our five reservations, and some of their acts of resilience are just so inspirational, really. You know, I keep telling people every day, I'm just so impressed that you're alive. I'm just so impressed that you survived childhood, you know, and I just really want to honor the fact that you're here talking to me. You know, however you're suffering in the moment, the fact that you're here is monumental. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about resilience. If we're running over, but you're so interesting and you are my hero. So.
Well, in looking at your work, you're my hero too.
Oh, because, thank you.
What you have done and accomplished, it's most impressive.
Well, thank you.
But there's something that is very, not just human, but it's about life, and it's that resiliency. You know of this Native scholar, and I can't think of her name right now, but she has this hyphenated last name, Weiss. She's Lakota, and she wrote in her doctoral dissertation that Native people are born into trauma. We don't go out and encounter trauma. We're born into trauma. And the idea of being born into trauma, it's, you know, we have to succeed somehow, even if it's just succeeding into the next day. And sometimes that's what it is. We have been placed in a position of subordination, of accepting that, accepting racism, that that's a way of life. I grew up in Oklahoma, born in Oklahoma, and thought I would never leave Oklahoma. But when you learn that racism is a part of life, you don't know that racism can change. You don't know that your life can change from coming out of poverty until you have seen someone or seen an example of where that something can be achieved. In my own personal life, I had no idea that working so hard could take you so far. As I said a little bit earlier, each book is, I think, my last book, because and you know that experience too. But it's that human experience of pushing on and pushing forward. And I'm very fortunate because there's a lot of people who have heart disease, who have addictions and things like that. And to literally celebrate each day of life, each hour of life. And we don't tend to do that, but we need to kind of be thankful for what we do have, even if it's not very much. A long time ago, my mother told me, when you have your health and happiness, you have everything. Mm-hmm. And she was a woman who's passed away, had triple bypass and was on dialysis and had a lot of illnesses. And so sometimes it's a struggle, but were we not meant to struggle? We don't appreciate life until we have struggled. It's like the champion who falls, you know, to the mat. If you win every fight, if you win every game and you've never been tested, but when you've been hit and you fall to the mat, it could be a wrestler. And it's the challenge is getting up from the mat, getting back up.
Indeed.
Another day and making the effort and sustaining that effort. And that's the resilience. And we need to remember that and to relearn that as Native people in order to teach that to our young.
You know, you remind me, there was an elder in whom I met in Eastern Washington at a Sundance. And he told me that we're programs on spirit television. And if everything went well, we would be canceled because we would get really low ratings. And so we have to have some challenges and some adversity in order to get high ratings on spirit television so that they'll watch and pay attention to us. And I thought that was really funny, but probably true. And also you remind me of my mother, and I just have to express my love and deep gratitude to my mother, whose position was that education was the new buffalo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and my grandmother made it to the third grade. My mother worked her way through college and pushed me, you know, to keep going. And, you know, I got to medical school. And I think we just have to appreciate our mothers. Your mother, my mother, I'm sure they're watching from spirit world. And I just want to say, Mom and Donald's mom, we love you. We're really grateful to you. You really helped us. You know, thank you.
Indeed.
Yeah. So, probably you have other things to do. And I just wondered if you had any final words for our students or for anyone who's watching, and just anything else you want to share before we stop.
Well, maybe two quick stories, and one that what my grandmother told me, because these are the kind of the driving virtues that I've kind of lived by over the years, and it's not always easy, but she was an individual who never went to school, believed in hard work. And so that's number one. She said, you know, I don't care if you're a janitor, be the best janitor that you can be and work hard. So work hard was really one of the virtues that she taught us, or all of us grandchildren. And two was family. And she said, family is important, and try to be a part of the family, be with family, be there when family needs you, and family will be there, you know, when and vice versa. She also believed in respect, and she said, even the person that you don't like them, respect them, because that's what it needs to be done, and not just respecting, you know, people, but everything if you can, and try. And the other thing was cleanliness. Lived on obviously my grandfather's allotment. They were married. She had a cook stove that was wood heated, and she had two irons. And so she would iron everything, pillowcases, sheets with creases in them, everything. And my patched jeans, I had a crease, you know, in my patched jeans when I stayed, you know, over the weekend, because she had washed my clothes and everything. So she believed in cleanliness and those four things. And so I just wanted to share that with you. And one more quick story. I accidentally ran into Lou Holtz one time on a plane from Chicago flying back to Phoenix. And so I knew it was Lou Holtz. He was wearing a baseball cap and was the ND for Notre Dame on top. And at the end of the flight, I'm not a Ford person. I said, Coach Holtz, I just wanted to say, I respect your coaching. And immediately he launched into a small lecture, and about six or seven strangers, we gathered around him. And he said, you need four loves in life. And this is what I want to end with. He said, find someone that you love and find somebody, that person who will love you just as much as you love them. And find something to do as your occupation, because if you love what you do, it's not really work, but you'll have that love for it. And he said, find some place to work where that you loved that place to go to every day, because it won't be difficult to go to work because you'll want to be there. And then he said, find some place to live that you love to live there, in that home or that house that you build or make or rent or something. Make it yours that you love. And when you have those four loves in life, you don't need anything else.
Wow, that's profound. That's very beautiful. Wow. Well, thank you. You know, this was awesome. And I probably said too many times that you're our hero. And you know, your work has been so inspiring to me and to my wife. And I'm just honored and thrilled to have been able to interview you. And I hope that we stay in contact. You know, we do come to Phoenix from time to time, and because we love Sedona and we love the Grand Canyon, and we have friends in Tucson, where I used to live once upon a time. So maybe we'll be able to meet you face to face at some point.
Let's do that.
Yes, let's do that.